I'm David Lazarus, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of January 30th, 2015. When I say crashes, what comes to mind?
Crashes?
Economic crash.
Market crash.
Stock market.
Oh, the stock market, the housing.
Stock market?
Oh, stock market.
Hitting a wall.
Relationships.
Someone dropped something?
Plane crash.
Coworkers. You crash with them.
Car crashes.
Car crash.
Car accident.
Auto crashes, I guess.
Car crashes.
A crash is a moment, sometimes minor, sometimes catastrophic. Sometimes you see it coming, sometimes it takes you by surprise. Awareness of crashes can be crucial to help us prepare for them, to weather them, to pick ourselves up and move forward. This is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. This week, we're talking about the crashes in our economic world, from entire countries to cities to you. We want to hear about how a crash has affected your life. Talk to us by visiting MarketplaceWeekend.org and clicking on Go. You can also visit us on Marketplace's Facebook page or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. For our first look at crashes, let's go big. People crash, so do companies and stock markets, and occasionally entire countries. We live in an increasingly interconnected world, which means that when one country crashes financially, there's a genuine risk that we could end up with a regional or even a worldwide pileup. Well, we wanted to find out how likely a crash of epic proportions might be, so we turned to the Wizard of Whiteboard himself, Paddy Hirsch. Paddy's a senior editor and the resident explainer here at Marketplace. He joins us now to discuss the global economy. So is it really all that fragile?
It can be that fragile, yes. I mean, we've seen it. We saw it in 2008 when the financial crisis hit here in the United States and rippled all the way across the world. And we had a massive global recession that came after that. And, you know, these recessions, these global crashes happen actually pretty frequently. You know, we had that global financial crisis in 2008. We had the 1997 Asian financial contagion, which like ripped Asia apart and rippled right across the global economy. Before that, we had the Second World War. That was pretty bad. There was the Great Depression before that. There was the First World War. So in 100 years, you're talking about five big financial issues. That's once every 20 years. That's pretty frequent.
But one would have thought that we would have learned from these experiences and that somehow all the central banks around the world would learn to circle their wagons very quickly anytime we saw the danger signs.
Well, I mean, we did circle the wagons pretty quickly after 2008. That was a really big problem when we had that meltdown. And in actual fact, they appear to have cleared things up pretty quickly, and look at the state of the U.S. economy now, doing reasonably well. The global economy not doing quite so well, but still sputtering along. But we didn't see a widespread global collapse that turned into something like a war, for example, which, you know, which can happen.
So since we contained the Great Recession, more or less, should I be encouraged? Should I feel like the threat of global economic disaster has been minimized?
I wouldn't say it's been minimized, but I think it's been mitigated. Yes, Greece looks pretty risky right now, and people are very, very worried about what happens to the Eurozone. You know, because if the Eurozone goes down and we lose an enormous trading partner in the Euro, then that's going to be a problem for the U.S. Trade in the U.S. is responsible for about 15% of GDP. Trade with the Eurozone is about 15% of that. Okay, so it's not a huge amount, but it would be a little bit bumpy for us. But it's not like we are so focused on Europe, or any country, in fact, is so focused on Europe, that a collapse in Europe economically would have this sort of tremendous ripple effect across the global economy. The global economy is actually pretty diversified, even though it is pretty well connected. The problem is actually more political. If you had big political issues in Europe, like, say, the collapse of Russia, for example, which is really suffering right now. Imagine what happens if you have bread lines and people rioting in the streets there. Then you've got all sorts of issues. You know, maybe that turns into a war, not because of directly because of an economic problem with neighbors, but because of politics.
So let's talk about the interconnectedness of the economy. Yeah, it's a small world after all, but at the same time, it seems like we've ratcheted up the risk by putting everybody into the same basket.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's both risk and reward there, right? Because everybody's so interconnected, it means that there is a risk that if one country goes down, then it brings a whole bunch of other countries with it. And certainly that's what you can see in Europe. People are looking at Greece and they're saying, wow, if Greece falls, is that going to, you know, pull Portugal and Spain and France down with it. So how can we kind of distance ourselves? How can we sort of ring fence Greece so it doesn't actually affect us that badly? And that's both the downside and the upside, because of that interconnectedness, it gives us a much better early warning system. You know, you think back to the First World War, more than 100 years ago now, nobody really had any idea what was going on in other countries, right? You didn't have that sort of communication. It took days for messages to get from A to B. Now messages pass in microseconds. So you have much better warning about what is going to happen in another economy, and you're able to react much more effectively as a result of that.
All right. So what do I, as you know, the proverbial little guy, I've got my 401k out there, I got my pension fund out there, I'm worried about harsh winds blowing through the economy. What do I look for to see if we are in danger of anything as catastrophic as we've been talking about?
Well, the lesson of the financial crisis of 2008 is don't touch your 401k. Yes, you want to be aware of what's going on in the world around you, but do not start yanking your money out of your personal financial accounts because you see wobblies going on in Greece or Russia or whatever. Do not panic. The fact is that we've seen that the US economy is exceptionally stable. And even though we had our own huge problems in 2008, it still managed to weather that crisis extremely well. Yes, we might see a small correction, maybe 3, 4, 5%. But, you know, over 10 years, which is over 30 years, which is probably the amount of time that you're going to be sitting on that money for, you're going to see the stock market rise. You're going to see your assets increase in value.
So when you look around you right now, what do you think is the likelihood that we're actually facing anything like a global economic crash?
I don't think it's that likely that we're going to experience a global economic crash, but we are going to see some fluctuation, right? There's some waves. We're already seeing some waves. I mean, Greece is a bit of a puddle, right? It's not an enormous economy, but it's already creating some waves in Europe. Russia, on the other hand, is a much bigger deal. Okay, it may not be an enormous trading partner, but it is politically extremely important as to what's going on in Europe. And as waves get created in Russia, you're going to see the knock-on effect in Europe. Just the gas lines in Ukraine is a very good example of that. And, you know, we saw fluctuation in the European economy because of what happened in Ukraine. So I think that those are the kind of warning signs you can expect to see. If you're hearing about conflicts, like armed conflict on the ground, if you're hearing about riots in the streets, those are two really big signs. We should be a little bit worried. And certainly that's what makes investors pull their money out.
But do the relative strengths of, say, the U.S. economy or the Chinese economy offset the instability of some of these other countries we're talking about?
Certainly, yes. I mean, the U.S. is, and not just the U.S., but also economies within Europe itself. So the strength of the German economy, the comparative strength of the British economy, the U.S. economy, yes, they provide a great ballast. You know, if the U.S. is doing well and the Brits are doing relatively well, that's a good counterbalance to problems going on in the Eurozone. The big question that everybody has right now is what happens if Russia starts to fail? Then you've got some real questions about what happens in Europe and what the knock-on effect to the US would be.
Paddy Hirsch, always a pleasure.
David, thank you for having me.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. A traumatic crash can be a very personal, deeply transformative moment, an event where life's momentum stops and your reality is changed. How do you move forward? How does it affect the way you look at things? Gary Dobbs dealt with that firsthand. For 31 years, he worked as a meteorologist at ABC's affiliate in Huntsville, Alabama. In April of 2011, Gary had just gotten home after a long day covering a tornado outbreak. With storm warnings still in effect, he laid down to take a nap.
And before I could doze off, I heard our chief say, our radar system has detected a tornado on the ground in Hackleburg and Phil Campbell area of North Alabama. Well, I knew that was exactly southwest of me. So I called. I said, why don't you put me through to the control room? And as this tornado gets close to where I live, because I know it's heading my general direction, I will just report on it for you. So I get on the front porch of my house, and the first thing I see is this huge wall cloud. And it was so massive, it covered the entire skyline from one horizon to the other. And the wall cloud was getting closer and closer and closer to me, but I still didn't see any tornado. And then all of a sudden, the wall cloud parts, and there it is right in front of me, about 100 yards away, and it was at least a mile wide. And it was the ugliest, nastiest thing I've ever seen in my life, staring me in the face with boiling black clouds. The minute I saw it, I said, well, now I see the tornado. It's right in front of me. It's heading straight toward me, so I'm really going to have to go now. And so I threw the phone down. Well, I got to the middle of the house, and then the house started exploding behind me as I was running. The walls exploded outward. The windows were exploding inward. I heard my car hit the roof of the house. I heard the pecan trees hitting the house. The house was literally coming apart on my heels. So I got in the closet. I knelt down. I put my arms over my head. And then in just a couple of 3 seconds, the tornado hit where I was. It sucked me down first into the crawl space and then pulled me up and up and over. I flew over the tornado shelter that I was trying to get to. It put me down in the backyard, and then it started piling the house on top of me. And I got hit by what I say is every piece of lumber and nail in Lawrence County, but at least that's what it felt like. I got hit by the washer on one side. I got hit by the dryer on the other side, which broke my ribs. And everything was gone. Everything was level. My house was gone totally. My neighbor's house was gone. The restaurant next door was gone. All I could see looking any direction was nothing but flat, except with an occasional vehicle that had been blown up into my yard from my neighbors across the pasture. As it turns out, all of my neighbors who were at home at that time were killed. And they were there 1 minute and gone the next. And so it certainly makes you stop and think and appreciate. We had a house full of antique furniture, just all kinds of valuables. This tornado was not like blowing a house over. This was like being hit by a bomb. Everything was in splintered pieces. And so there was really nothing salvageable. So everything from that point on in our lives was substantially downsized to what we felt like we only needed. Before, we had had all this stuff that, you know, was just stuff that was pretty to look at, but it wasn't a necessity of life. So it changes your perspective about things and the value of things.
Listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. I'm David Lazarus, in for Lizzie O'Leary. The economy, it's clearly on the mend. Stocks are up. Corporate profits, up. The gravy train, it's chugging along. But not for everyone. If you look around, it seems like a number of people have crashed through the safety net and are out on the street. The Department of Housing and Urban Development says the most common length of time that someone is homeless is 1 or 2 days, and half the people who enter a homeless shelter will leave within 30 days, never to return. But that impression might not be shared by everyone. To find out more about the state of homelessness in 2015, we turn to Patrick Marquis, Deputy Executive Director of Advocacy for the Coalition for the Homeless. Patrick, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the program.
First, I'm having a hard time getting my hands around the actual scope of the problem, because when I look online, I see estimates that put the national tally of homelessness in the hundreds of thousands, some in the millions. How big is the problem?
Well, the problem is big and, by all accounts, getting worse. Homelessness has always been incredibly difficult to measure accurately for kind of obvious reasons, you know, counting folks who are sleeping out on the streets or, you know, sleeping in train terminals and places like that. It's always going to be a difficult thing. Plus, we have the problem of what many of us call the hidden homeless, when you've got families and individuals who are living doubled up with other friends or relatives or sleeping temporarily in motels and things like that. So you have these kind of very temporary situations. It's not just the folks who are sleeping rough on the streets. It's not just folks who are sleeping in shelters. The problem is even bigger than that. The federal government estimates that there are about 600,000 people experiencing homelessness each night. But we know that number is actually bigger than that. This is a problem that is huge and that's getting worse.
Not to be cynical, but is homelessness just a part of having a large urban environment? Will there always be people who either by misfortune or by choice in some cases want to be outside the system?
Absolutely not. I mean, I think it's important to realize that the period that we're living in now of modern homelessness that really began in the late 70s, early 1980s, is in some ways unique in American history. We had periods of kind of mass homelessness in the Great Depression in the 1930s, obviously. We've had a period since the late 70s, early 80s, the last 30 years roughly, where we've seen this problem. But before that, we didn't. It's not like there were no people who were homeless, but we didn't have hundreds of thousands of Americans experiencing homelessness each night in the 60s and 70s. And that's because we had a stronger safety net in some ways, particularly when it came to affordable housing. We had less of a gap between incomes and apartment rents and housing costs. A whole host of other reasons. So this is a problem that absolutely has real and effective solutions. What we're really missing is the leadership from government to really make it happen and to make those key investments.
I suppose some people might think there's a stereotype about the homeless, that they're all mentally ill or they all might have substance abuse issues. That's not the case. I mean, these are people who, for lack of a better word, just simply, in many cases, got unlucky.
Clearly, there's a sort of stereotypical image of who's homeless. It's seen as kind of the older man panhandling on a sidewalk or on a subway train. But in reality, the majority of people who experience homelessness are families and kids. I know, you know, in the neighborhood that I live in New York, there was a woman who was a waitress at the local BBQ restaurant in my neighborhood. And, you know, she was a homeless mom and her two kids were sleeping in a shelter right in the neighborhood. You wouldn't know it, but that's actually one of the places you're more likely to find folks who are homeless is low-wage workers working as security guards, home health aides, waitresses in fast food restaurants. You know, these are the folks that experience homelessness in many ways, and it really cuts across the stereotypes.
In other words, it's you, it's me, it's people we know.
It's the working poor. A third of homeless families in New York City shelters are working families, some of them working two jobs. These are folks who are doing their best to make ends meet, following all the rules, and yet they can't find housing that they can afford.
Patrick Marquis is the Deputy Executive Director for Advocacy for the Coalition for the Homeless in New York. Patrick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you again.
As Patrick mentioned, it's difficult to measure statistics on the hidden homeless, those whose personal economies have temporarily crashed. Darlene Bell Grayson found herself in just that situation recently. She moved to Los Angeles after living in New York for 15 years. She held a variety of jobs in the Big Apple, from desk jobs to gigs on Broadway. Grayson never had trouble finding work until she found herself here.
I'm homeless. I really am homeless. But I'm not the homeless person that you see and you think is homeless. I'm not on the street. I'm not dirty. I'm not raving and needing medication. I'm not the typical face of a homeless person, but I actually am. And I don't know where I'm going to go, and I don't know what I'm going to do. It just never crossed my mind that I would ever be in a place of being without, because I had saved so much. I lived on very little when I was doing a Broadway show, and I always had it in my mind, I want to be able to make it through the lean times. So I learned from my parents budgeting very well, and my mom is really, really good with that. And so here I am. It's now June of 2012. I have no unemployment. I have no job. I have no prospects. I have no rent. I don't have family with the resources that can jump in and help me. I was just at a loss for words. And it's not because I did anything. I'm doing everything that I know to do to find work, and I'm pursuing work in avenues that I wouldn't ordinarily even go to, that I'm just trying to take care of myself and nothing's happening. When I say nothing, I had nothing. I mean, I don't have rent. I don't have food. I had nothing. And then I got very sick out of nowhere. I got a job, and then I wasn't able to start the job because then I got shingles. So now I'm contagious to some people that haven't had chickenpox. I can't look for work for a month. I got behind on my rent. I have never missed my rent in my adult life. And at that point, I had been on my own for 20 years, a little over 20 years. I've never been late for my rent. And I've got friends, but I didn't have friends that were in a position to do a whole lot. There had been another person that I didn't know really that well, but had heard that I was in a very tough time and opened her home to me. And I thought, I'll be here a maximum of 2 months. 8 months later, when I moved, but I was living on her couch for 8 months. It allowed me to, first of all, find a job, be able to save money, to get back on my feet. But the question that was always in my mind was, how did I get here? How did I become homeless? What decisions did I make on the way that led to this? I would ask other people that knew me well enough that would have an unbiased eye, and they're just as mystified. You don't realize that you look down on others that are in a hard time. It's just, it must be that they did this, this, and this. I didn't do any of those things, but life still happened to me. I never thought that I would actually say this. I wouldn't have changed it. I don't regret having gone through it. I will grow from it, but I wouldn't change it.
Listening to Marketplace Weekend. In last week's show, we asked you to tell us stories of your own financial crashes. Many of you wrote into MarketplaceWeekend.org, including Christine Koenig of Long Beach, California. She lost her home, her car, and her belongings when a 15-year relationship came crashing down around her. Hitting bottom involved years of child support payments to her ex-girlfriend, and Christine wonders if the immense changes in her finances could have been avoided by something that wasn't legal for her at the time, marriage. Well, she's in a new relationship now, and she's married. Robin Gourneau wrote to tell us about how her husband Alan changed his carpentry business in the wake of the recession. He stopped building custom cabinets and started restoring pianos and soundboards. Business took off in 2008. It hasn't slowed down since. For Michael Brent Collings, a financial crash inspired a change in career, from lawyer to writer. At first, things were off to a rocky start, but then, well, let's hear it explained with a quote from one of his published novels.
Laughter is a benevolently contagious disease, and it brings lightness of spirit and increase of resolve. Perhaps that is why it is so close to madness at times, because it brings hope where none could possibly exist. You know, like in life, they're traveling through this journey that they don't necessarily understand, but they have choices at every moment where they can either choose to despair or they can choose to find joy. I was in my 30s and I was at a law firm in Los Angeles, and I had graduated from a top 20 law school, and I did all this as part of a plan. You know, I'm going to be reasonably successful. I didn't want to own the world, but I'm going to have money in the bank, and I'm going to take care of my family because that was a big priority for me, and I'm going to know where my next meal is going to come from at all times. And I had more or less succeeded at that. You know, my wife was a stay-at-home, a home maintenance operator of expert. And then all of a sudden my wife was diagnosed with a pretty severe back problem. And I started taking more and more time off work to deal with that. And then all of a sudden I found myself at odds with the partners about how I was spending my time. And that partnership dissolved. So I packed up and left, and I didn't have a job all of a sudden for the first time since I was 14. I had nowhere to go. And so I'm, you know, the alternatives were to sit around in my house and feel weepy and sad and eventually blow my brains out, or to do something. And I wrote a book called Run. And just as with my law career, I could not get any traction with this book. I sent it to every publisher imaginable. And if you had rolled me in gold dust and sent me in through their front door, they wouldn't have touched me. And then a friend told me about this Kindle thing, and you can put it up yourself. And so I did. And the very first month, it sold, drum roll, about 6 copies. And I'm pretty sure my mom bought all of them. Not that I had a genetic predisposition toward horror, but I was a small kid, and I was smart, and I was, you know, kind of a twit. And so I got beat up in school, and I couldn't do anything about that but write a story where I murdered this rotten kid who kept beating me up. And that made me feel a little better. And over the years, I gravitated away from revenge writing and discovered that horror, it's a superheated furnace that separates those things. You know, most of us aren't going to find axe-wielding maniacs in our lives, but we're going to find mean neighbors, we're going to find bad days. And horror sort of examines those things in extremis. And I kept writing fruitlessly. And then 6 months later or so, a friend of mine emailed and said, "Hey, Amazon is pushing your books on me. What's up with that?" So I went back on Amazon, which I hadn't really visited since I uploaded the book. And all of a sudden, I see that my book is doing incredibly well. And it ended up being their number one science fiction and horror title and being in their top 100 titles overall on the site. And I was floored. And all of a sudden, I thought, hey, maybe I don't have to work as a lawyer. Maybe I can do this.
Next week, we're talking about cheating. Have you ever financially cheated? Did you cheat on someone you love? Maybe you cheated yourself. Tell us your story by visiting marketplaceweekend.org and clicking on Go. You can also chase us down on Marketplace's Facebook page or tweet us. We're at MarketplaceWKND. Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
I'm David Lazarus, filling in for Lizzie O'Leary on Marketplace Weekend. Our regular tech maven, that would be Marketplace Tech host Ben Johnson, is in an undisclosed digital location. He'll be back again next week. So today, we turn instead to Katie Benner, tech columnist with Bloomberg View. Hiya, Katie.
Hey there, David.
So let's talk crashes, specifically tech stocks. Are we in a bubble or are we not in a bubble? You wrote the other day, no, we're not, at least not yet. Make that case for me.
Well, I think that when we talk about bubbles, it's more helpful to talk about cycles because all sectors, all things, they go up and they go down. Nothing goes up forever. Nothing goes down forever. So we are definitely in an upswing right now, and eventually it will go down. And I don't think it will go down just yet.
Okay, but stocks go up, they go down. That I know. But then pets.com, AOL.
Well, we don't have a pets.com situation.
Well, we don't. But then we look at the valuations of some of the tech stocks that are out there right now. And I think a lot of individual investors are thinking, oh, my goodness, is my 401k safe? Is my pension fund safe?
I'm going to say that your 401k and pension funds are probably safe. One of the interesting things about the tech bubble, some people are calling it a bubble. Some people are just saying that the asset class is growing in value. However you look at it, most of it's not happening in the public stock markets. It's happening in the private company markets. It's happening with companies like Airbnb, Uber, Square. These are not companies that are publicly traded. Yet these are the companies where all of the value is being created, where investors are pouring money in, venture capital investors and other private market investors. So if there's an inflation happening that people are concerned about, it's there. And we, you and I, our 401ks, we don't touch that stuff.
But wouldn't the danger be that as these non-public companies become inflated with venture money, other public companies bask in the reflected glory and we start seeing tech stocks all rising?
That could start happening, it's true. But what we've seen with the last few IPOs is that the companies have gone public at dollar values that are less than what they were valued at by private investors. So if a company was valued by private investors at $1 billion, we've seen a couple of companies, including New Relic and Hortonworks, that when they had their IPO, they were valued at less than $1 billion, which shows that somewhere in the public stock markets, people are showing some signs of restraint.
You know, there's a sense that people just don't want to miss the party. And since the big growth, the home runs, can come on the tech front just as much as the big flameouts can come on the tech front, people, I think, have a certain sense of denial that, oh, well, maybe it's not going to happen to me. And so I'm just going to pump my money into XYZ.com and hope that I get the big bucks. And it's like all of the things we learned about prudent investing get thrown out the window when we're dangled with the prospect of getting in on the ground floor of the next Facebook or the next Twitter.
I've been so rational and calm throughout this whole interview, and now I can sort of start to concede that, of course, you're right. This is human nature. I think that it's called behavioral finance, but you and I can just say this is how people are. We saw it during the housing bubble. We saw it during the first dot-com boom and bust, where people do think they're going to miss out. And so they do things like buy houses they can't afford with mortgages that make no sense. And they throw all of the fundamentals of good investing out the window. And I don't think we've ever had a boom that has not crested on the wave of that kind of exuberance.
I saw a quote the other day from John Doerr. He's a very prominent Silicon Valley venture capitalist. He said a few years ago, when he was asked whether tech stocks were getting overheated, he said, quote, "I prefer to think of these bubbles as booms. I think booms are good. Booms lead to overinvestment, to full employment. Booms lead to lots of innovation." Yeah, and that's why he prefers to think of them as booms, I guess, and not bubbles, because bubbles are bad.
Well, booms are good. It's just the bubble part is bad. And I can't recall a time when we've had a boom without a bubble that didn't pop.
Katie Benner is a tech columnist at Bloomberg View. Katie, thanks so much for messaging with us.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. I'm David Lazarus, in for Lizzie O'Leary. We've been talking so far about all kinds of crashes, global, personal, but how about literal crashes? I mean car crashes. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration estimates that the cost of car crashes runs about $871 billion every single year. And the price tag can be even higher for car makers. Recalls. The Fed say we can expect even more recalls this year, which is saying something considering that 2014 set a recall record. Lauren Fix, an automotive analyst, joins me to talk about what's causing all these crashes and all these recalls.
The auto industry really has put a lot of effort into making their cars safer. And I think the result is more computers, microprocessors. When you're thinking about the average car having 24 computers in it, it obviously lends to possibly or potentially more recalls. And that's exactly what you're seeing is problems with computer screens and microprocessors, and all that, of course, leads to more work. And unfortunately, NHTSA keeping very busy.
You're saying then that cars are becoming more complicated, and that's why they're going into the shop more often.
Well, they are more complicated. I would say overall, as you're looking at the mechanical portion of it, they tend to be more reliable. When you're looking at every time you add a computer, and hey, who hasn't got upset with the computer that's on their desk, or you just get so frustrated it moves slow or it doesn't function the way you'd like it to, or a program gets jammed up. Think about the same thing in your car. Of course, all these computers trying to work in sync, in perfect synchronicity, is where you end up with problems.
Okay, and that's one way. But the other thing that we saw last year was just a lot of funky parts out there. For example, General Motors recalling about 27 million cars because of that faulty ignition switch. And then all those Hondas and other vehicles recalled because of those funky Takata airbags out there. How much of this is automakers learning to recall first and ask questions later? There were some deaths, there were accidents, and now it seems as though if there's even the hint of a problem, the first reaction from a car maker is, I better recall before the lawyers come knocking.
You are correct. That's exactly what's happening. Initially, you were looking at, well, we have a really nice relationship with our contacts at the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, and they would sit there and discuss it and maybe do a regional or a local recall, or if someone came in the dealership that had a problem that met that criteria, they would replace those components at no charge. It got to be way too friendly. People would leave the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and work on the OE side or the manufacturer side because they knew the ins and outs, they knew the procedures, and they were able to bypass some of these procedures. And the results are what we're looking at right now. So what we really need is someone making these manufacturers follow the rules so that we don't have a knee-jerk reaction when there's something teeny like a latch on a hatch of, you know, five cars causing a massive recall. And unfortunately, what we have right now is recalls and all these components of all the manufacturers saying, I don't want to be the next one in the press. I don't want to be the next GM, the next Toyota, or the next whoever. So that's why you're seeing the reaction that you're seeing now, and more recalls are the result.
So as a consumer, when I receive a recall notice in the mail, and I did get one just recently the other day and had to bring my car into the dealer, is that something that I should freak about, or is that just becoming business as usual for being a car owner?
I wouldn't freak, but I certainly wouldn't put it on your desk and say, I'll get to it next week, next month, next year. The fact is we really need people to do is react proactively. Contact the dealer, contact the service department, give them your vehicle identification number, and they can actually run a full list and see, are there any what they call TSBs or technical service bulletins? Are there any recalls? And let's get them fixed rather than waiting till you're too late, you're in an accident, or the next time you bring the car in for service, that's too long.
And obviously, it's hard to say how much any particular fix will cost, but I saw a fascinating number the other day. Again, this one from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, saying that the annual price tag for car crashes runs about $871 billion in economic loss and harm to society. That's a really big number.
Right. Now, you're also looking, when you're talking about that huge number, you're not just talking about damage to cars, damage to property or people, you're also talking about lost work, and you're talking about liability, disability, and health issues. So there's a lot of impact when someone has a car accident. There's $62 billion in undone maintenance. 9 out of 10 cars have something wrong with them on the road, and that leads to an accident. And now that little teeny expense is now something much more amplified.
Clearly, most people depend on their cars for their livelihood. If you get a recall notice and it says bring it in right away and there's going to have to be some work, a lot of people don't really have the time to give up their wheels for that long. Is there any advice you can give?
Sure. All the recalls on the ignition switches and the airbags are actually ones that the dealerships really want your business. And so what they're doing is they're offering you free rental cars or loaner cars while the problem gets resolved. An airbag only takes a few hours and an ignition switch as well. And so it's to your advantage to bring the car in the morning and maybe pick it up after work or after school or whatever your situation is. But ignoring that problem could put you into a very deadly, risky situation. And I certainly wouldn't wait.
Automotive analyst Lauren Fix, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. So what happens when a city crashes? Detroit's collapse, that was a painful experience for those who went through it, and for others who may have wondered if it could happen to their town or city. And now, Atlantic City is facing its own financial reckoning. 4 of its 12 casinos have closed, and thousands of workers have lost their jobs. This month, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie hired an emergency manager to help turn the city around. Whatever ends up happening there has ramifications for municipalities nationwide. To explain what happens when a city goes bust, we're joined by Michael Sweet. He's a municipal bankruptcy attorney with the law firm Fox Rothschild. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now, let's sketch out for people, first of all, that this might sound wonky, but in reality, what we're talking about are pension funds, what we're talking about are public servants, the ability to maintain a police force, a fire department. This is really serious stuff.
This is about the nuts and bolts of going through your everyday life in a city where a lot of people live, and people who might go to Atlantic City for gaming or other entertainment and then leave, you don't frequently stop to think about the fact that there's people who live in Atlantic City and do business in Atlantic City and who, you know, dial 911 in Atlantic City and expect an emergency crew to show up or need the streetlight outside their house fixed. You know, the libraries, the schools, the parks, the stuff of everyday life in any city in the United States, that's present in Atlantic City as well.
All right, so let's talk about how a city gets into this fix. It's not that Atlantic City put everything on red and it came up black. What happens? What leads to a financial problem of this magnitude?
I don't know that they put everything on red and it came up black, but they put a lot of eggs in the gaming basket. A lot of chips on the table, maybe we'll say. And as gaming dollars have gone down, it's affected the way they're able to pay for municipal services. And they probably didn't address the drop or expect the drop to be as precipitous as it's been, which means there's now a scramble going on to figure out how to fill what appears to be about a $20 million gap in a $260 million budget. And, you know, that's not a rounding error. That's a pretty big number.
I would imagine every time we have talk of a major city either filing or looking at a bankruptcy, civic leaders in other cities feel tempted to go back to their people and their unions and say, you know what, we're also looking at deficits. We're also looking at problems. And if you can't come to the table with some givebacks, we might have to go down this road as well.
You know, it's always a possibility, and it's certainly, I think, a discussion that we've been seeing more since you saw Detroit. Before that, you had Stockton, Vallejo in California in 2010 or 2009. You know, as more cities are faced with no choice but to file bankruptcy, it causes the cities that maybe aren't quite in that bad of shape to say, well, let's sit down and talk about how we're going to fix our problem, how we're going to restructure our debts. And to be clear, bankruptcy is truly a last resort. I don't think anyone relishes the decision to file bankruptcy. Certainly in the public sector, it's problematic, both from the perspective of an elected official who is looking for his or her next elected office, from the relationship with the workforce. The labor component is huge, and in a city, when you're affecting your labor force, it's also people who live in the city. I mean, a city like Atlantic City, you've got police and fire who don't only serve the city, they live there. They're part of the fabric of the community, and it can really tear the community apart. What we look at is ways that folks can have a discussion about how they might restructure their debt obligations and avoid the bankruptcy. And frequently, that's been a successful discussion. There have been a lot of instances where the discussion has started and people have looked at the bankruptcy option and realized that's not the best way to go. And I think you're right. I think that as people start talking about this with a city the magnitude of Atlantic City coming on the heels of Detroit, there will be discussions like that in other city halls all around the country.
And quickly, is there a short list of other big cities that might be on the list of possible bankruptcies?
Look, I'm sure everyone has a short list. There are cities that are more like Detroit or Atlantic City than others. And let's be clear, Atlantic City hasn't filed bankruptcy. They haven't even said they're going to file bankruptcy. In fact, what they're saying is they're looking at ways to avoid filing bankruptcy. They're looking at ways to address the structural inefficiencies they have and get rid of this budget deficit and try to turn the corner without filing bankruptcy. So certainly there are cities that have put a lot of chips on the table, so to speak. But the underlying issues that are facing cities like Atlantic City and Detroit and Stockton and San Bernardino are also facing a lot of other cities around the country that folks might not have heard of, but that have the same issues. And it comes from underlying budgetary inefficiencies that are related to long-term pension commitments they've made, retiree health benefits they've committed to give, drops in revenue because of property values that dropped in the Great Recession, and other budgetary problems that make it very hard for them to do the day-to-day stuff of running cities, which again is providing for public safety, keeping libraries open, maintaining parks, maintaining the infrastructure that people count on to live their day-to-day lives.
Michael Sweet is a bankruptcy lawyer with experience in municipal bankruptcy filings. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much. My pleasure.
Finally today, Atlantic City is home to, yep, a bunch of casinos. And casinos were home to Josh Axelrad. He used to be a professional gambler. Now he's a writer and a dad. He told us about his crash and how he was made whole again.
I played cards for a living for a number of years, which is to say I was a card counter. I played a winning systematic game of blackjack, had been thrown out of many casinos for winning money and playing well, and then went through a spell where I was on a sort of an extended busman's holiday. I was gambling recreationally and also, in my case, badly, to the point that it became deeply problematic. I lost about $50,000. I ended up living in Seattle with the woman who is now the mother of my kid. I hadn't thought about cards for a long time. I started poking around some of the small local casinos that they have here. And I started playing around for fairly low stakes using the modest amount of wealth that I had at that time as a blackjack bankroll. I was doing the equivalent of flipping burgers in the blackjack world, playing games that might have been worth $10 an hour. I thought it was impossible that the 50 G's I'd succeeded in vaporizing would ever come my way again. I wandered in this casino where I observed a shuffle that was not random, which is something that you come across periodically. After they shuffled, you would have some indication of when certain specific cards were likely to reappear. And coupled with the particular side bet that they had on this game, where there was a big jackpot payoff if you got a specific hand, so the hand was two queens of hearts, that combination of those two things, the side bet and the non-random shuffle, created an unusual opportunity. With the particular bet I was placing, I was betting on the appearance of these queens of hearts. So there's a large edge associated with these bets. However, it can be the case that you have a large edge on something and you still lose and indeed expect to lose for long periods of time. And with this particular bet, that was exactly the case. Two queens of hearts is a hand that does not come up very often at all. So even when you're able to successfully predict the appearance of, say, one of those queens of hearts, or even of two of them on a particular round, the odds against their lining up on the very same hand are vanishingly small. And so I sat down to play this game, and I happened on exactly the sort of situation I had hoped to find myself in. There were two queens of hearts due to appear on the very same round. The edge that I had on that bet was enormous. The individual bet that I placed in mathematical terms was worth thousands of dollars, and yet the expected outcome, the most probable outcome of placing that bet with that very high mathematical value, was actually to lose it. So I placed the bet, hoping to see these queens of hearts, and they landed. Effectively, I placed a $300 bet. It was a $30,000 jackpot, and I knew immediately what had happened. I knew immediately what they owed me. It was a small casino attached to a diner, and what the pit boss does, finally, he takes a small scrap of paper, and he writes down on it, "I owe you $30K. We eventually, you know, come to terms. They bring some more documentation and finally take me to the cashier. And to my somewhat astonishment, are able to actually produce $30,000 physical dollars in cash, which I jam best I can in my jeans pockets. The play that I did in Washington State, I ended up recovering more than what I'd lost playing poker badly. It had felt good initially, but it also, after a while, ceased to feel like anything one way or the other, which is how it ought to feel. On the one hand, I felt tremendously vindicated. On the other hand, what that vindication put me in a position to do was to proceed to a state of mind and a state of being where I no longer needed vindication.
To hear a longer version of Josh's story of two very lucky ladies, visit themoth.org. We'll be right back.
that's our show for this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Ament and Eliza Mills, with help this week from digital intern Seth Kelly. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Charlton Thorpe is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. Lizzie's off on assignment, working on a collaboration with our partners at the BBC. You'll be hearing her special reports. Well, they'll be coming up real soon. Meanwhile, PBS NewsHour's Lisa Desjardins fills the big chair for Lizzie next week, and we'll be talking about cheating in today's economy. I'm David Lazarus. Thanks for listening. This is APM.